Not many of us heard about sexual harassment much before the 70s, but our guest on this edition of Conversations will tell us that most of us thought about it a good deal when we were boys and girls. I'm Susan McInnes. On this edition, we talk with Fran Seppler, and our topic is sexual harassment and adolescence. Stay with us. Fran, welcome, and thank you.
Nice to be here.
I want to start kind of at the periphery of our discussion. In a piece that you co-wrote with Walter Barra, a psychologist, you both said that the civil rights movement and feminism started a cultural shift in perceptions about what is socially acceptable behavior. Can you look at that for us? How did we start shifting, and where do you think that shift is taking us?
It seems to me that if we track back historically, we've gone from a culture where there was really a single perspective about what was normal to a place at the time of the women's rights movement and the civil rights movement where people who felt outside of that normal started questioning it, to now some very real universal scrutiny about our norms and our behavior. There came a time when women and people of color were asking to participate differently and equally in our society in a way that they'd never done before. And when that self-exploration and those discussions began, the Congress, legislatures throughout this country realized that in order to make equal participation in work and in school and in the daily commerce of our lives, to make that happen, that we needed to look at creating some laws and some policies to help. Well, affirmative action came, equal opportunity came, and at some level there was a declaration by this country that no matter who you are, not only should you have an equal right to exist, but you should have an equal right to compete in the marketplace and to be educated. What became apparent very fast is that getting in the door, being admitted to the college or being hired into a job, didn't make you equal. It made you different and it made you there. And that while you were there, if you were treated badly enough because of who you were, you could be driven out. And so the public policymakers and I think the general public started to realize that there's more to equality than just making rules that say you can do the same thing, you compete. It really came down to looking at how we treated each other on a day-to-day basis. That's a level of self-scrutiny we've really never had before in our culture.
These issues feel like sand in the oyster that could either create pearls or distress the oyster continually. What's your read on how we, as a culture, are looking at ourselves through this perceptual shift? Welcoming, resisting, maddened by it?
We're really in a time of some turmoil right now. There are a lot of people who have been concerned about treatment for a long time who declare loudly and appropriately that there are real problems with the fundamental qualities of respect and dignity and equality in our culture. And there are also many of us who, if we're being honest, are concerned about giving up what feels good to us and what's comfortable to us to make others comfortable. And so we have a lot of tension right now. We haven't yet found a place where I can change my behavior enough to be sure that you're comfortable without feeling afraid that I'm somehow sacrificing something. And you don't trust me enough to notice when I am making the adjustments. And because of that, I think it's a tough time.
You said a natural time? Are we where we're supposed to be?
I think developmentally we are. When you look at any kind of social change, it tends to be a very rocky process. And we've gone from one extreme to another. Certainly the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings a few years ago brought us to a real pinnacle of some parts of our culture being outraged, some parts of our population being paranoid and angry and afraid about what was going to come. And I think it is a natural process to work back towards the middle, and then something will swing us off again. But the sweeps become narrower and narrower, and more new behaviors are being embedded in our day-to-day conduct.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like good news. This is Fran Seppler, our guest on this edition of Conversations. Fran is the president of Seppler and Associates. She spent a decade and a half or more in the area of public service, agency work, working with gender equity, sexual assault, other problems relating to women. And how many years ago did you found Sepler & Associates?
5 years ago.
5 years ago, Sepler & Associates came into being. This is a private organization that's working on these same issues. More about that as we go along. Speaking of the taking of sides and the general disgruntlement, the umbrella question I want to ask you is how much is what is sexual harassment understood or misunderstood these days? And under that, what I want to ask you about is what I take to be a lot of cultural muttering. You can't even call somebody honey at the office anymore. What happened to that easy intimacy we used to have in society? There's lots of frivolous charges going on about sexual harassment. All of that. I mean, that's what I want to ask you about is our extent of understanding or not understanding.
That's the whole ball of wax right there. Sexual harassment, first of all, is a legal term. Let's recognize that to begin with, that if it wasn't for the law, we would still have the behavior. We wouldn't have the name sexual harassment for it. So if you're really asking me, do people understand what they mean when they say sexual harassment?
Yes,
I would say both those people who consider themselves very strong advocates against sexual harassment and those who are sort of the social critics who think it's all a bunch of bull are, for the most part, inaccurate when they're using the term sexual harassment. Sexual harassment has come in the daily parlance to mean everything from you're bugging me or you're obnoxious to you're raping me. What the law defines as sexual harassment are some fairly narrowly constrained things. One is what we call quid pro quo, the traditional old-fashioned kind of sexual harassment where somebody says, have sex with me and I'll promote you, or don't do it and I'll punish you. But more profoundly, hostile environment sexual harassment, which means that serious, pervasive, continuous, negative, sexually oriented or gender-based behavior is so pervasive in your work environment or your educational environment that it affects the fundamental terms of your employment or education. It has interfered with your right to exercise your right to education or employment. So sexual harassment is a very serious set of behaviors. Outside of the legal context, there's a lot of behavior that is sexist, obnoxious, rude, crass, and crude, which tells us that there's a risk for sexual harassment that ripens the environment for harassment that can be part of sexual harassment, but from a technical standpoint may not meet that standard.
Are people trying to make the law fit the insult in some ways? And that's what people would call frivolous charges?
I think there are people who would like to have the law defend them or speak for them whenever they feel offended. And particularly working on college campuses right now, as much as I do, I'm really struck by the number of students I encounter who really have understood sexual harassment protections to mean that they will never need to be offended in their life, which I don't know if things have changed a lot since I went to college, but that's a pretty hard, pretty tall order. And then you also find people interpreting overly broadly on the defensive end, as you said, the people who say, well, I'm just not going to take a woman, an associate, to lunch because I could be accused of harassing. So we've seen a really chilling effect from the overinterpretation of harassment, and in some cases, I think, a real withdrawal of people from their willingness to resolve conflicts in a less adversarial or formal way.
Something that interests me, and I think this is maybe a good opportunity to move into the meat of our subject. You have written, and I feel in the curriculum that Sepler & Associates put out, an inability among youngsters to talk to each other about these issues. It probably should surprise us not at all that adults have a terrible time talking to each other.
It astonished me. When we went out and we talked to hundreds of kids, and they would tell us about things that had happened to us, sometimes terrible things. And we would say, well, you know, could you tell them? And they'd look at us with horror in their face and say, oh, I could never discuss this. I could never say anything. It was as though there was a functional gag on a lot of kids. Talking about conflict generally was hard for them the idea that they could actually talk about conflict around gender or sexuality was beyond them. And for many of them, the choice to suffer in silence was a much more palatable choice than the choice of actually raising their concerns.
Let's take a look at this issue then. The American Association of University Women did a study in 1993. Lou Harris did it for mm-hmm. them. It found some pretty amazing things about sexual harassment among adolescents. Can you introduce us to what was found? What did they conclude?
The most striking thing about the AAUW survey is it validated what a lot of us working in the field had known for a long time, and that is that sexual harassment is part of growing up in America, that most kids have either experienced or done sexual harassment, and in a lot of cases, both. When you define sexual harassment in a broad way, and I want to be very clear that AAUW used the term sexual harassment, did not define it, so that when we're talking, here we're talking about broad range of unwelcome sexually oriented behaviors.
This is not the laws that you described a moment
Correct.
Ago. Okay.
Correct.
What kind of behavior, unwanted, you said, mm-hmm. What other umbrella words can we use so we can get a grip on what we're looking at?
Unwelcome, sexual, or directed at them because of their sex, behavior that created fear or anxiety or shame for them, things that upset them, things that disturbed them, things that disrupted their ability to study, to participate in school, to be completely comfortable people. So we're talking about stuff that had serious effect. And in sexual harassment work, we look at the effect rather than the behavior. Mm-hmm. The children, and they were children, described a fairly routine environment involving a lot of verbal harassment and quite a bit more touching harassment than I think any of us expected to see. And some of the very same kids who described their own experiences as being really hurtful and painful were also the ones who said, and then I did it to somebody else.
Huh. Now, this is an interesting phenomenon. We take, is this right? In our culture, we tend to divide perpetrators from victims, and the twain does not meet. You say it not only meets, but the twain are brother and sister here.
Absolutely, and this is something that when I'm teaching teachers, I work really hard on, because in a lot the minds of a lot of us adults, we see that there's the bad kids doing things to the good kids, and what they have to do is really look at that crowd of children in their classroom or in their auditorium or in their school and say every one of them has one side on which they're very vulnerable to harassment by other kids, and every one of them has a side that's capable of hurting another. And we really need to be taking care of both sides and teaching kids to recognize them, because there is no sharp line. And the place where the sharp line, the fictional line that keeps being drawn, disturbs me the most is when I keep hearing that sexual harassment is something that boys do to girls.
Because, my next question. Go ahead.
The AAUW data and then our own survey clearly showed that both boys and girls are harassers and harassed, and that our children are at risk, all of them. And to the extent that we take our adult framework of corporate sexual harassment and try and impose it on kids, it doesn't stick. It doesn't fit.
These characteristics really change this notion of what harassment is for me. I mean, I think before I ran into you, I thought, as most people do, what is it that I want you to do for me? Make visible this universe. What is it that our kids are living in and creating for themselves and having done to them?
Well, let me give you a snapshot, if I can, of the four different kinds of sexual harassment: boy to boy, boy to girl, girl to girl, and girl to boy. And boy to boy harassment and girl to boy harassment actually look most the same. Boys harass girls as a matter of circumstance. Boys rarely plan their harassment, and the kind of harassment boys do to girls begins generally with lots of verbals, name calling, making admiring sexual statements or making negative sexual statements. They will call a girl sexy, they'll make a comment about her body, and boys will generally do that in groups. A girl will be walking down the hall and a group of boys will whistle. Another boy will try and one-up the first boy and make a comment about her breasts, for instance. And if the girl reacts, they will do that again when they see her again, and they'll repeat the behavior. And because boys are focused around mastery as a peer group, they will try and compete with each other for who can be more explicit, who can take the greatest risk. So sometimes this will escalate to touching. It also involves negative sexual comments, like calling a girl a slut or a whore. Although, generally, those kinds of negative sexual references, if boys use them, are more in the form of the written word. Boys will write it in graffiti. They won't necessarily say it all that often to a girl. They'll say it to other boys. Girls, when they harass boys, are much more inclined to do it through notes and phone calls, letters, and sort of secondary contact.
Which is one-on-one rather than pack-on-one.
Correct. Although girls generally are behaving in dyads, they tend to work in twos. Whereas boys, it's sort of harassment of convenience. Girls tend to plan it a little more. The two of them will be sitting at home, they'll say, let's call so-and-so. And they'll harass a boy by volume. And if you're a parent of a male adolescent, you know the feeling of having the phone ring for the 20th time and the same girl's calling. And boys really find this very disturbing. When we confront girls with it, they say, oh, I'm just calling because I like him, or we're just teasing, or he shouldn't get upset. But boys really get very, very emotional about feeling pursued. And for them, it's very harassing. Girls also do a lot of graffiti. Girls do a lot of note writing, and I always make a joke that our firm is going to do a bumper sticker that says girls do it in writing, because girls are really prolific written harassers, and they will write some of the most graphic and explicit notes that you could imagine, and they'll send them to other girls, and occasionally they'll let somebody intercept them.
This is Fran Sepler on Conversations. The curriculum that Sepler and Associates has put out in concert with a couple of other co-writers is called Crossing the Line, and is a curriculum for high school, junior high school as well?
Middle school and high school.
Middle school and high school students. We're talking today about adolescence and sexual harassment. I can hear in the back of my mind people who are saying, oh, for heaven's sakes. This is hazing, this is rite of passage, this is sexual game playing, and this is how kids learn to relate, mm-hmm. learn to set limits, learn to deal with harassment, and harassment's part of the social mm-hmm. life. So what's the problem?
And I think we have to, and that's why I tried very hard at the beginning, to make a distinction between merely offensive behavior and harassing behavior. Can I tell you a story?
Sure.
Jamie was a 10th grader in high school, and she had had a situation where she had reported some kids on the hockey team for sexually molesting her. The police were involved, there was a proceeding in juvenile court, and the kids were found to have done this. Everybody in the school knew that Jamie had pressed charges against these hockey players. First, the hockey players' parents started calling her parents. Tell your daughter to say she lied. Our team will never win. These boys' careers are ruined. How could you do this? This is terrible. Her parents stood by her. Jamie started walking down the halls at school, and people would sneak up behind her and go, rape, rape, rape. They would torment her. They would send anonymous notes calling her a slut and a whore. There was a picture from well-known magazine with a centerfold that was Xeroxed, and her yearbook picture was put in the place of the face. The word slut was written across her locker in red ink, and tampons were hung from the locker. I got to know Jamie when I was helping draft the first legislation in the country to deal with sexual harassment of students, and the day before that that bill went to final passage, Jamie took her own life as a result of the intensity and the power of what was directed at her. There is a place where normal adolescent testing turns into cruelty, fear, and shame-invoking behavior.
And this is mob behavior as well, isn't it? I mean, we are mindless of responsibility or consequence, which are mm-hmm. aspects of individual behavior, and we go with that other brain-dead thing.
The kids tell me that they do it because their assessment is that what good they can get out of the behavior is more powerful than their perception of the negative consequences.
What good are they getting?
Girls, for instance, who harass other girls feel really close to the girls they're working with. generally it'll be a pair of girls that'll go after or target another girl, and they feel really good about each other. They feel really close and intimate, and they get a thrill out of breaking the rules and pushing the limits. And if they find it very hard to empathize with a receiver of the behavior, in part because they'll say, well, mm-hmm. somebody did this to me, and I lived through it, and they can live through it now. Boys are doing really kind of a show-off thing, and they describe how their status grows in the eyes of their peers. They're admired the riskier they can be and the more mastery they can demonstrate. And they think it's funny, and they get kind of a rush out of taking the risk. So when we say, don't you know it's hurting someone, we hear over and over from these kids, well, you know, I kind of know that, but I really don't experience that when I'm doing it. I just think they should let it run off them. And a lot of kids do. A lot of kids put up with this stuff. They have terrific coping skills. They say, that's just the other kids, and they get by. It's the kids who have less elaborate support systems, the kids who are less loved, the kids who have family situations that are under some stress. I just dealt with a young woman who was being harassed at her school. She said, I've been putting up with this stuff for years, but my mom was in surgery this week. I'm depressed, she said, and she burst into tears and said, I just can't take this anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's what we see, is that the kids hit a saturation point. There's just nowhere else for it to go. And that's when the damage starts. Mm-hmm.
And in Jamie's case, this can be long-term critical damage. Do other children, you think, experience signs of injury over time, or signs of injury that really do have scholastic consequences or social consequences or the like?
Oh, no question. Kids tell us they will just check out of school, either psychologically, emotionally, or physically, to avoid harassing behavior. I had one young man tell me about being dragged into a bathroom and having a group of older girls mark up his genitals with permanent marker and as a way of teasing him. And very blithely, it had happened some years ago, he said, well, I didn't talk to anybody about it. He said, I tried to kill myself, that didn't work. And then he kept going on. This is serious stuff when that saturation happens. And I think what happens is we say, well, each behavior isn't so bad, they're just kids. But we don't know which kids have cups that are just about to brim over and which ones are containing it real well.
Mm-hmm. Is this something that's brand new in our culture? Is this something we can blame on the sexual revolution or feminism or backlashes, or is this forever as far as you can tell?
I think if any of us people who are over a particular age are honest with ourselves and we think back to our own experiences, we can both remember things that happened to us that were cruel and things we did to others that were cruel. Mm-hmm. And that's always the thing that I think we have to remember, is that we got it and we gave it both. And we called it teasing, or we called it being mean, or we called it bullying. And what has changed is that I think kids have more sophisticated sexual knowledge and an ability to banter sexually that has really gained in sophistication over the years. Certainly TV gives them lots of ammunition that I didn't have. And I think that ups the ante and makes a lot of the teasing and bullying more inclined to have a sexual element to it.
You talked about a boy who, I forget, he didn't tell somebody about it, or he did, and then Jamie, who had the support of her mother. Is this a closed system or an open system? Are kids talking to each other and to their parents when they're abused? Or is this something that each kid does differently?
Well, what we do know is that they're not telling us. They're not telling the adults in their life about it. What I tell teachers and parents is that by the time your child will come to you, they have probably talked to three friends about what's going on. They will turn to their peers first. And that's one of the reasons that I'm a big supporter of peer intervention and peer support, peer mediation, and just peer intervention, because kids will talk to other kids. They will share great details in their feelings, but they have a tremendous reluctance to tell adults, because we have a way of taking control of the situation for them. Mm-hmm. They're very concerned about their social realities. They're worried nobody will like them anymore. They're worried they'll be looked at like a geek, or like somebody who's not okay. And so all of those social fears keep them from telling us, because we aren't great problem handlers for them. Mm-hmm. So I think that what kids are telling us by where they're going for help says that there's a natural support system out there that we have to really educate. Unfortunately, most kids don't know how to help their friends, and they'll simply say, yeah, bummer, too bad, or, you know, don't tell me about that. There's nothing I can do, and I don't want it to be directed at me.
So the support system isn't there among the kids either.
Right, except where the kids have been educated. And we've had some wonderful successes with peer education programs where kids realize that they can create and actually execute interventions on their own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. On this edition of Conversations, we're talking with Fran Sepler. The curriculum that was written by Sepler and Associates is called Crossing the Line. It's a video-based curriculum where youngsters are shown different segments regarding sexual harassment, and then they talk about it. This is all facilitated. It's very interesting to me that the way you approach the school system is to say, spend 3 months talking to the adults and then talk to the kids.
Right.
Why do you do that?
If you go to a school and there's a big curriculum in place and it's Anti-Sexual Harassment Month, and then you go into the teacher's lounge and people are telling beaver jokes, you've really got a cultural message there. There is a lot to work through to get comfortable with this issue, and the development of an educated environment means that we have to get past finger pointing and blaming and shaming and get to a place where both men and women feel equally invested in stopping or preventing harassment. And the teachers have to do their work first. They come with biases, filters, concerns, and if they aren't educated and aren't doing their own work, the kids will spot them a mile away and our message will fall on dead ears.
So much like at the very beginning of our discussion where you talked about a cultural shift, this is a shift for everybody, parents, administrators, teachers, the lunchroom, and then for the kids.
Sure.
Yeah. This is Conversations. On this edition of Conversations, we're looking at sexual harassment and how it affects adolescents. Our guest is Fran Sepler. She lives and works in, are you in St. Paul or Minneapolis?
St. Paul.
In the St. Paul end of the Twin Cities.
Thank you for not mixing those up.
She lives in St. Paul and works in St. Paul, where Sepler and Associates is located. Our guest on this edition, Fran Sepler. I want to thank you again for joining us for this hour. Okay. When you then go in with this curriculum, with an effort to transform the school's culture, how long a process do you anticipate this taking? I said a couple of months before you even introduce the curriculum, but what's your sense of what it takes to change a school culture?
Well, let me make clear that the curriculum is only really a part of overall education. We actually have a K through 12 continuum that we talk about, where the words sexual harassment don't even come up for kids until about fifth or sixth grade. And before then, you need to be introducing children to the concept of respect, safety, the right to be safe and the right to an education, communication, and teaching them that they are their best own advocates and problem solvers. These are things, and talking about gender too. You need to be doing that starting at kindergarten and first grade and giving them lots of opportunities to practice problem solving and communication with one another before you even begin to broach a shift in your culture. In addition, when we introduce the curriculum at middle school grades, we give them the language and we give them a little bit of a repertoire to begin to know what it is that's happening, to give it a name, to seek help with it if they need to, and hopefully to solve some problems. Mm-hmm. But we don't go the next step, which is to catch the little germs or seeds of these problems as they're beginning. And that's really where you have to go beyond the curriculum to make a difference in the culture.
I want to ask you about those first steps, those K through whatever, fifth or sixth, let's say, before hormones kick in. Mm-hmm. How welcoming, this curriculum's been set up in a number of communities. How welcoming are communities to this kind of a discussion? This is touchy stuff.
Well, it's touchy stuff. It's also What we have is a hammer behind it. Several states now have enacted specific legislation which requires schools to educate around sexual harassment. Certainly Alaska is one of them. In addition, there are two cases coming to the federal courts this year or beginning of next year, which will actually be litigation around sexual harassment in schools. There have been a number of civil rights and human rights complaints before and investigations, but this is going to be, there's going to be some money paid out, taxpayer money paid out to people potentially. So I think that communities are assessing their risks and realizing that the time to educate is before the crisis. Once your school has been embroiled in a battle around sexual harassment, trying to educate is like swimming upstream. It is very, very tough. People are polarized, they're positional, they're angry, people are pointing fingers, and you can't get in there and talk about what to do right. So I think the assessment is being made more and more. Certainly our curriculum has been very successful all over the country, and that tells us people are realizing it's time to start talking about this.
Good.
I have had challenges. We do a lot of parents' nights and a lot of people in the community who feel that this is too many resources and too much time spent on an issue that isn't important. And I guess as a parent of kids who have a lot of work to do in school, I too get concerned about how much time we all have to spend on behavior. But ultimately, we have to do what it takes to make sure that my kids and everybody else's kids can do what they're in school for, and that's to learn. And that means we have to address the behavior, not punish it when it goes out of control.
Now, tell me about punishment. I have an indication from one of your pieces of writing that that's the inclination of a school or a school district when it runs into a case of sexual harassment. What are they doing, and what's the problem with that?
It always worries me when I go into a community to do a workshop on sexual harassment for educators and all the disciplinarians show up because they see it as it's an enforcement matter. It's sort of like parking, you know, you give a ticket when somebody does it wrong. Nobody wins a good parking award. And that's the way a lot of school districts have taken on sexual harassment. Well, if we have a policy against it and we punish people who violate it, we've done our job. What do we know about punishment? First of all, we know that punishment for sexual harassment has not been demonstrated to extinguish the behavior. If I use sexual language and I'm punished for it, I may stop for a while, but it'll reemerge. There's really no connection between the punishment and what I've done. And we also do a tremendous disservice to kids if we haven't taught them the expectations before we punish their violations. It's also a real tendency to intervene in a real shame-based way. One of the things that just makes my toes curl is to see kids goofing around in a hallway and a teacher come up to them and go, okay, you kids, that's sexual harassment. Quit it. Stop it. Because it's real shaming for those kids. They don't know what they're doing is a problem. They don't know why. And we work a lot coaching teachers about intervening with kids in a much more constructive way. You know, how do you think it made you feel, the other person feel, when you did that? Do you think you could have expressed your feelings in a different way? Really a problem-solving approach. We are a society that likes to blame people, likes to find people guilty for doing bad things. And particularly with kids, I think those are very counterproductive approaches. We need to be a lot less about deciding who's to blame and a lot more about communication and fixing it.
This is a harder thing to do.
Much more labor intensive, requires a great deal more creativity, and ultimately nets us healthier, less hung up, less neurotic kids.
What I was thinking about actually was not that, although it's good that the what happens is that kids are less neurotic in the end, but was that if I just say to you, friend, cut that out and do 40 push-ups or something for having done it, I'm done with it. But if I come to talk to you about your behavior, to a certain extent, I'm vulnerable to my opinions and biases, and the way I treat men or women or both all come up.
Oh, sure. And to the extent that somebody might go and say, let's talk about your behavior, and then say, well, I can understand why you feel that way and validate the behavior, that obviously can be an issue. Mm-hmm. So that's why we do the work with the staff beforehand. This morning we did a little scenario with the teachers and involved a girl having yanked off a boy's hat in 10th grade and the boy calling her a slut. And now the girl had come to a teacher saying that she was she was really upset and didn't want to confront him because she didn't want to make a big deal of it, but wanted him to know that being called a slut had been a problem for her. And we had really a lively discussion about whose responsibility that scenario was, because a lot of people connected with, well, she messed with him. She took his hat. Mm-hmm. She agitated him. Shouldn't she be held responsible? And a lot of people who came up on the other side saying, well, wait a minute, you know, he didn't have to call her a slut. He could have said, stop it or don't do that. And it was a very lively debate. And as everybody tried to decide who was going to get in trouble and what kind of trouble, I found myself saying, whoa, folks, time out. Mm-hmm. How do we solve this problem? And it was real clear that punishing either one of those parties would cause a tremendous ruckus amongst their peers. But how easy it would have been to take these two people and sit them down together and say, so Al, how did you feel when she yanked your hat? And so, you know, Jane, how did you feel when he called you a slut? And to have them really hear from each other, much harder, mm-hmm. much riskier, much more potentially explosive. But what those kids could learn from each other is something that we could never teach them by punishing either of them.
Is this the best thing about the curriculum from your point of view, is that it exposes feelings and responses to each other? It lets us take a look at our inner lives across the room from other inner lives?
I think that it sets up a dialogue. It gets people talking and having a window into other people's sensibilities. We are a culture struggling with diversity right now, and one of our tendencies is when we see something to view it from our perspective and our perspective alone. Well, if somebody did that to me, it wouldn't bother me, is one of the most common things we'll hear. And so I think it's very important to climb inside the head or the mind or the spirit or the soul of somebody who's not at all like you and realize how different something feels. And we try and do that through video and through our facilitating some really candid discussions. And it is, I think, particularly wonderful for some girls to hear from boys what it feels like to know that their behavior is suspect. I remember facilitating a group of 17-year-olds just recently, and a boy was just wonderfully talking about how he feels going into a parking lot at night and seeing a woman there and knowing she's afraid of him. Mm-hmm. And feeling so helpless in that situation. And one of the girls said, you know, I always thought you guys were a bunch of jerks before. I thought you just lorded this sort of power around. And it was a wonderful opportunity to hear that. Mm-hmm. And it created a new understanding. Those are the bridges that we try and build.
Mm-hmm. This is Fran Sepler on this edition of Conversations. Before she founded Sepler and Associates, she was the executive director of the Crime Victims Program for the state of Minnesota, and was that for the years 85 to 91. Between 1980 and 85, she had various positions with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. She is individually and with Sepler and Associates a consultant to business and schools, agencies, the media, and more, regarding sexual abuse and sexual harassment policy development and implementation. And Fran has been doing this work since 1980. In a bit, I'll tell you about some publications that you may be able to find, and Fran will help us know whether we can find these in libraries or whether we can have to go to the source in a bit here on KUAC. Fran's won a number of awards. She has been the co-chair of the Minnesota Attorney General's Task Force on Sexual Violence. And for her work on that task force and as co-chair in 1989, she received the Marvelous Minnesota Woman Award. That's a beautifully titled award. Must just make you smile every time you think about it.
It does.
Yeah. Also, was chosen as the Outstanding Young Woman of America in 1989. She's won State of Minnesota Achievement Awards in 81, 83, and 85, and several others. Fran Sepler, our guest on Conversations. I do want to tell you one other thing. If you would like to get a hold of the survey done by Lou Harris for the American Association of University Women, it's called Hostile Hallways, as in school hallways, the AAUW Survey on Sexual Harassment in America's Schools. There is an AAUW chapter here in Fairbanks. If you can just get a hold of someone there, I'm sure they'll help you. Fran Sepler with us on this edition of Conversations. This is a softball question, but I really do want to know it. What do you like best about what this curriculum is doing. You say you've helped to develop it, you've helped to implement it, and you've worked as a facilitator with students, and you come to places like the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District and talk to teachers about what it's about. What do you think what's the best thing it does?
What I'm proudest of and what I like most about not just this curriculum but all of the work we do in sexual harassment is that we come at it from a really practical, real life, real people perspective. A lot of the information we get about sexual harassment is in the form of political messaging, advocacy, blaming, pointing fingers, bemoaning, criticizing, or suing. And we take the issue of sexual harassment seriously by starting every project we do by listening to the voices of the people affected. What I'm proudest of about this program is that the kids wrote it for us. We came with no assumptions or biases or presumptions about what sexual harassment looked like in the teenager's world. Instead, we went out and we talked to hundreds and hundreds of students and let them tell us what the problem was. And because of that, kids dealing with the curriculum and adults dealing with our products feel that they're dealing with something honest with no hidden agenda. So they trust it and they work on it and it changes the way they behave.
Sexual harassment is something that slides around. It's not, you can't, unless you've got a law, and that's very specific, it's hard to get your hand on. How do you approach what was flirting 5 seconds ago? Janie took Bob's hat and then turned into harassment for only one of them, or what was uncomfortable shyness and blurting that was taken wrong. I mean, how do you deal with those odd things?
When we talked with kids, they were really clear that there were differences between flirting or what they would call the yucks, uncomfortable, you know, icky or yucky situations and stuff that really hurt. And so we sliced those up into 5 different categories of experience: flirting, what we call boundary slippage or the icky stuff, and sexual 2 forms of sexual harassment, all the way through to sexual assault. And we decided that one of the best ways for students to talk about this together would be to take one scene between 2 students and shoot a video where we changed it just enough every time that they could see the differences and respond to them. And what that does is it gives students a name for what's happening right now. Right now I'm flirting, and that's because both of us want it, it's welcome, we feel good, there's only wanted touching. Or this must be boundary slippage because I feel icky, I feel uncomfortable, but I like this person, I'm affectionate towards them. They want more from this friendship or this relationship than I do. When they have a name for it, they can talk about it. If not to the person who's involved with them, they can talk with their friends and do some problem solving and figure a way to fix it or to change it or to modify it, or if necessary, to get help from it.
Break into this list of 5, because I want you to go on with it, and tell me what boundary slippage looks like, because that's an abstract word more than flirting for us.
As an adult, I'll tell you what kind of boundary slippage you've probably experienced. If you've ever been on a plane ride somewhere and you sit next to somebody who wants to talk to you and you don't want to talk to them, and you sort of do all sorts of nonverbal things, generally you'll look at a book and or you'll look at your watch or you'll get very interested in the vomit bag or something, and they'll know that for the most part that you're not interested and they'll withdraw. But sometimes you have that person who keeps talking, right? And what do you generally do? You abandon your effort to try and set a boundary and you let them intrude and you are fairly miserable. You really wanted to read or you wanted to do something else. That person's behavior has slipped over your boundaries. And I always say to people, why don't you just tell that person, shut up and leave me alone? And we all have very good reasons. Oh, I don't want to make them mad. I'd hate to have a surly person sitting next to me. Oh, they're nice people. I don't want to make them feel bad. Now, this is somebody we're going to be sitting next to for, 2, 4, 6 hours, and then they're gone. Imagine if you're experiencing not horrible, but unwelcome behavior from somebody you're going to have to deal with indefinitely. You'll tend to tolerate things that they do because they want more intimacy or more time or more contact with you. And you put up with it and you're still uncomfortable. And that's the adult version. In the kids' world, it's somebody who wants to be better friends. And you don't want to tell them to go away. You don't want to hurt their feelings. So you tolerate it, but you're never fully comfortable.
Flirting, boundary slippage, what else?
The two Three forms others. Of sexual harassment, hostile environment, and quid pro quo.
That goes back to the first two we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay.
So we have one scene in which he's basically pressuring her and making comments about her appearance and that the teacher likes her because of how she looks and insulting her. Mm-hmm. And then the quid pro quo where he threatens to spread a rumor about her if she won't date him or be sexual. And then sexual assault, which That's is... Right. The terminus, the very worst.
Is this a continuum? Does what we think of as date rape and sexual assault among peers emerge out of sexual harassment?
I'm usually very clear that although quid pro quo harassment, threats of doing bad things to someone for not being sexual, is on a continuum with sexual assault, that hostile environment harassment is not. Uh-huh. That they are separate, that kids can be very verbally abusive but never pose any risk of a physical assault to someone.
How do you work with kids to help them get to the point where they can talk to each other? I think in a number of your list, not every one of them, I can remember not saying a word forever in high school and junior high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I probably, if I were back there now, wouldn't say anything now.
Because?
Oh, I don't think I felt I had the power.
And that's precisely it. One of the things that we hear from students is that I don't say anything because I don't think it would do any good,
mm-hmm.
or I think that people wouldn't like me. So we take care of that. One is that we share with them that about 70% of sexually harassing behavior is not intended to hurt its target. There's a sense that, oh, it won't bother them, or, you know, it's no big deal. And that if people get the information, if kids hear, this really hurts, that they will probably withdraw from the behavior. So we use some information. We have them practice with each other. We have them tell each other, what would you want to have happen if your behavior was harassing someone? And we let them tell each other, I would want somebody to tell me. But most importantly, we talk about peer systems that maybe I can't tell you what you're doing is bothering me, but maybe I can go get my friend Jenny. And maybe Jenny will come with me. And then I'll feel enough power with Jenny for me to say, I want to talk to you. Or maybe I can write you a note. Maybe I can say, this is what you did, and this is how it felt, and this is why I want you to stop. So we try and engineer options for kids and turn them into problem solvers.
You, in the course of your work, have... I'm sorry, I can't quite source this, but I think the curriculum encourages kids to create their own standards for the school environment. Is that so? Yes, am I right there?
It's an exercise we do a lot with kids,
okay.
where we have them imagine what a school would be like without sexual harassment. And we even have done the exercise where we separate the boys and the girls, and we have them in groups write open letters to one another about, and generally it starts, we don't want sexual harassment in our school. These are the things we want you to do. These are the things we want you to know. And the letters are fantastic.
Huh.
The girls will say things like, we want you to be our friends without sex. And we're really insulted when we're upset and you blame it on PMS. Mm-hmm. And the boys will say things like, we don't know how to be friends with you. Or we're afraid that you're going to spread rumors about us. So in some cases, these letters have been so powerful that the schools have put them up at the entrance so that the boys and girls can remind each other the things that go unsaid between them.
How successful is this in practice? I mean, these are wonderful exercises. What's your sense of what happens when the curriculum is done and Sepler and Associates goes home?
Well, Sepler and Associates doesn't come with a curriculum,
I
and I think that's really important in that we want to train people in districts to be there all the time, reinforcing and re-reinforcing the messages. We train people to do that inside their own districts. How much does it work? I think there are kids who feel more empowered and like better problem solvers than they used to. I think that there is less really bad behavior because kids won't tolerate it as well after they've talked about it. I think that it is the beginning of a generation of students who will grow up understanding they have a right to an education free from this stuff and asserting that right. But we've got a long, long ways to go. There's plenty of student-to-student sexual harassment still occurring. And unless we can change the parents and the teachers, we may just have to wait till the next generation to see a sea change.
This is an old paradigm operating with a potential paradigm shift happening in another generation.
Yeah. And I think to the extent that we can move away from the shame and blame model of pointing fingers and saying it's your fault, it's your fault, it's your fault, we're going to get a lot closer to ending this. I have yet to meet an educator who thinks that brutalization or demeaning one another is a good thing in their school. And if, as long as we can agree on that, we don't have to sweat the details. We can just talk about respect. Mm-hmm.
I promised you a bit ago that I'd talk about publications if you'd like to find them. This is something in press, and Fran, you'll have to tell me more about where it's going to come out and when. It's called Negative Immunity and Organizational Irritants. That's quite a title. The Experience of Workplace Sexual Harassment. Where is that coming and when?
That is in peer review right now. That is a study of 1,000 people who are either claimed harassment or were harassed. Claimed harassment or did the harassing in the workplace. And every time it's in final version, we get more data. So that'll be coming out hopefully within the next year.
And from?
Hopefully it'll be in a journal, a professional journal, but I'm not free to say which one yet.
Okay. If that's something that interests you, we'll encourage you to find Sepler Associates in a year, if you can remember that. Mm-hmm. That'll be good. The Invisible Line is a corporate approach to preventing harassment in the workplace. Came out in 1992. Is this a curriculum for healthcare workers? Is this the one?
We have one for business, and we have one called The Invisible Line in healthcare, both of which are marketed by Sepler and Associates right now.
Are these, for lack of a better word, curricula similar to what Crossing the Line does in schools?
Very similar. Videotapes, trainers' manuals, participant guides, all focused on bringing people together, creating dialogue and discussion around workplace behavior.
Okay. Let me break away from this list just to ask you, is it different operating in a workplace than in a school? Do you find that youngsters are more amenable to this kind of learning than are adults in a workplace? Or are we both interested in resolving this problem wherever we are?
It's entirely different. It's one thing for you to go to a seminar and your employer says, look, if you behave these ways, you're going to lose your job. And it's another thing to be in a school environment and be told these are our expectations. Nobody's going to fire their students. Students have a right to an education. So you have really different assumptions coming into it. And the kinds of behaviors we're dealing with are very different. The kinds of attitudes are very different. Adolescence is a time of necessary testing. It's a time where hormonal misfires are routine. Being embarrassed and doing something wrong and making a mistake is to be expected. And so the it's trickier with kids to talk about what they can and can't do. Corporate sexual harassment, behavior between adult men and women, also has some trickiness to it. And we have to be very careful not to let that environment chill, because I think it hurts both women and men when that happens. But we are dealing with a more specific type of behavior, and I think it's easier to talk about.
In the workplace?
Yes.
Are we more polarized, on the other hand, in the workplace by such flagship cases as Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas, where we all made up our minds and went to one side or the other side of the room?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of bad education about sexual harassment, and that has polarized people. I'm really afraid of the effect that it's having in particular on young women, because I keep talking to men who are so scared that they have really withdrawn from bringing women along in their careers. And it's because somebody brought in a big hammer and said, don't. We do a lot of remedial work in those settings, bringing men and women back together. Sort of, it's okay, you know, let's talk about what we do well and what we do right. But we've had some real serious chilling in the workplace and have a long ways to go to get out from under it.
I asked you at the very beginning of this hour whether you thought this was, and this, referring to what you were talking about at that point, was a natural developmental phase, if our misunderstandings of each other is natural. Is this place where we're backing off and a little afraid of each other, gender by gender, part of our evolution as human beings, if we're moving towards a new way of being men and women on the planet?
I think perhaps it is. I think perhaps that stepping back and really examining the relationships, first in the shadow of fear and then because we're in a place to make a more calculating assessment, does give us an appreciation for the fact that men and women are different, that the notion of saying you can just treat everybody the same and it'll be okay didn't work, and that we may need to find a new set of ways to deal with one another. And that's really where a lot of the thinking about diversity comes in, that we have to have room for differences in perspective and differences in expectations and differences in preferences, but not room for disrespect. Mm-hmm. And that means that we can't all just say, well, we'll just go to work together and it'll all work out. It means we have to be a little more deliberate about how we behave.
Mm-hmm. You like your work, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I can tell. This is Fran Sepler with us on this edition of Conversations. I hope it's been an interesting hour for you. It certainly has been on this end. Let me tell you again, in terms of workplace, education, the invisible line, one for healthcare and one for other workplaces. Yes?
White collar and blue collar.
White collar, blue collar, and healthcare? No.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
There are three editions of The Invisible Line: white collar, blue collar, and healthcare workers. In any case, it's a corporate approach to preventing harassment in the workplace, brought out by Sepler and Associates, been around since 1992.
And also, we have a program for colleges and universities, The Invisible Line, on campus, that's on 200 campuses around the country, and I think the University of Alaska has a copy of it somewhere.
Okay. Crossing the Line is the one we've been talking about the most today, a curriculum to prevent teen-to-teen sexual harassment. It's distributed by Kitchener Reese from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and also has been around since 1992. This curriculum is in 1,000 school districts around the country. There, I think that's it.
Okay.
I want to thank you very much
Sure.
for this hour with us. We've been talking today to Fran Sepler on this edition of Conversations. Fran has been the guest of the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District and has been doing staff development around the subject of sexual harassment. My thanks. Best regards.
Thank you.
And I hope you join me again next week.